Our time now is 1:45. Apologize for our little, we've delayed twice, but we had good conversations in the meantime. Our intent today is essentially have a conversation, shorter, not longer, to sort of close the loop on any issues that are out there that the administration want to discuss, that committee members, you know, had on their mind that had been raised in the process, so that tomorrow, when we start addressing a CS, we've sort of got some finality, or at least interim finality, for lack of a better term, as we go forward. And we're confident, at least at the first step, that most people's concerns have been addressed. And with that, let me just lead out by, we gave Commissioner Galvin earlier the ConocoPhillips concern about triggering the floor based on scenarios. And I just ask you to comment on that to the extent that you can. It appeared to me, just listening to it in a vacuum, that, I mean, there was, they painted a scenario, we could do that. We just need to understand, you know, what the unintended consequences might be.
Sure, Mr.
And each of you have, I think, a copy of the ConocoPhillips presentation, so.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. What we have looked at the slides that were provided, and I'd like to have Rich Ruggiero with Gaffney Klein provide his comments on it and give you some insight into the, I guess, the sensitivity that this has to being, you know, adjusted one way or the other, and how it might change the outcome.
Okay, and before we do that, let me, I'm remiss in a couple things. Senator Green, Senator Wilikowski just joined us. Senator Stevens, Huggins, and Stedman are present at this time. And we have Senator Hoffman and Senator Thomas in the audience, and I don't see any other senators or representatives. But please continue. Mr. Ruggiero.
Okay. I'm without my glasses here. Chairman, do you have the whole presentation that Conoco gave the other day?
Well, this is the slides we have, as I recall.
Right. I wanted you.
And there's the version they used with us, as I recall.
What I want to take you first as a setup and understanding what they presented, and I think they're being very fair. It's on what they call their slide five.
Right.
It's entitled Impact of the 10% Legacy Floor. What they state under the second bullet is that the minimum tax can be triggered by two events occurring. One is high investment. The other is that investment in a low price scenario.
Right.
Now, it's not impossible that that will occur, but it's unlikely that if there is a projection of very low prices that you would be having extremely high investment. So that's the first thing that you have to take away from this, is it is under a set of circumstances that has a probability. When we go through their slides 6, 7, and 8, well, first 6 and 7, is what they've done is they've run an example, basically assuming one barrel at a $50 price. And roughly you've got $10 operating expense, and then they run two different scenarios. One where you've got a $10 CapEx, that would be the equivalent to reinvesting about 25% of the otherwise profit in there, the 50 minus the 10 in cost. And then they run a case of a $20 investment. Sorry, I'm on slide 7. I see some questioning eyes. And they compared the two and showed that when they're reinvesting 25% of their profit in a low price scenario, that the tax that they would pay under the ACES 25% net profit is greater than the floor at 10% applied to the gross revenue. However, when you go to the very high investment case, under the net calculation, with the credits given, the tax would be a dollar, but the minimum tax says, no, you have to pay $5 in tax because we have this otherwise minimum in the proposed legislation. So again, what they've done is they've given you a set of circumstances of low price, very high reinvestment as a situation under which this could occur. But what I want to do is point out, and I think, again, being fair to what they've done, they then said, let's take a look at this on a more park-wide valuation. So if we go to slide 8. And again, they run through the same type of calculation, but using more of the volumes that you would expect to see in Kuparuk and applying, as they have in the footnote, the prices that are in this PPT status report. What you find when you do that, and as they show here, is in the potential high investment case that their tax bill under a straight net would have been 228. Their tax bill, because of the minimum, is 280. Now, what I want you to keep in mind, that's a $52 million difference, okay? Now, let's go back and let's talk about some of the things that ACES offers that they don't get in other jurisdictions. ACES offers the immediate write-off of the capital. So in the calculation on the right-hand side, they have taken immediate write-off of the $800
million. Excuse me, immediate means over 24 months, right?
The capital gets to be deducted in the year spent.
Okay, go ahead.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. If I get it wrong, I'm sure my partner on the left will correct me.
Well, yeah, 24 months is correct under ACES.
24 months.
To write off the CapEx or the credits?
CapEx.
Okay.
Yeah, so
24 months.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Actually, okay. Rich is right. We have to make sure that we're talking about the same thing. With the capital expenditures, you're able to, in Rich's words, write them off, and in the sense of deduct them from your income in the first year. It's the credits, when you get down to the second part of it, that is spread over the 24 months.
Okay.
And we're going to get to that as well. So they've been able to write off the 800 immediately, which in other jurisdictions, depending on where you go, that might be a two-year process, that could be a 10-year process, to write off that capital against production-based taxes. Again, this is when I said before, you know, the write-offs that you allow under PPT and ACES are very generous for investment. As they come down through their calculation, they then also subtract from the tax otherwise due the credits. But here they've taken the full 20% in that 1 year. Now, I believe if I've got this right, if that 160 was actually down to 80, which means they've over-deducted by $80 here, the minimum would not kick in on this example, because the difference is $52, but I think they've overstated the credits by $80. But even on the assumption that somehow we get a situation where they had the right credits, they could create an example similar to this where it does take them below the line in the minimum. The point I wanted to make, that if you add up the 800 and you add up the full credits of 160, that's 960. What they're actually able to deduct to reduce their taxes, even if we go to their minimum number, and forget the mistake on the credits, they're able to deduct 908 of the 960, or they were able to take advantage of 95% of the credit available to them. And the other 52 would have just carried forward to the next year. So the loss would have been, in that example, their perception of the time value of being able to skirt that to the next year. So even in this example, which they tried to put onto real numbers and representative numbers for Kuparuk, I don't believe that the minimum creates that big of a problem.
Okay. That's Senator Green.
Doing your illustration and going back through this, your comment on the first part of that under potential was that this is in comparison to other jurisdictions in the world. Okay, but is this the same scenario under the current PPT, or would this just be because of the rewrite of PPT?
Because of the floor.
Then yes, under PPT they get to write off after that.
Correct.
Yeah, this would be representative of the current PPT, where they what they've done is they've mixed two things. The current PPT allows the immediate write-off of the credit, but PPT doesn't have the 10% minimum floor. So they've mixed pieces.
I'm just saying that the comparison to other jurisdictions of the world is not as germane as a comparison of the amendments to PPT as the original PPT. And I would say that's the comparison that we should be hearing about.
Correct. And that was my comment the other day about the difference between a great system and a fantastic system. You know, it's discussion of degrees of good. And it's not, as opposed to one's bad and one's good, in my way of looking at it. But again, if they actually handled the capital credits correctly in this example, the minimum wouldn't have kicked in. And yet, as you can see, they could have doubled their traditional capital spend in the Kuparuk area, according to this, without any impact from the floor kicking in at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Chair, in addition to the points that Rich made, because the other observation that I had just in looking at these slides is just thinking about it in terms of how realistic is it that we're going to be facing this type of a scenario when you look at the discussion that we had yesterday relating to the cost assumptions and the fact that we are now looking at a North Slope average of about $14 per barrel operating plus capital expenditures. You know that the legacy fields are on the lower end of that average, and so they're going to be below that average. The low level assumption here starts with a $20 assumption. $10 per barrel of OPEX, $10 per barrel of CAPEX. And then in order to get to what they refer to as their potential, they're up to $30.
You're on slide number seven.
I'm on slide, seven, sorry. And so what they're saying is under what they refer to as a low, which is still higher than anything we're experiencing now by a significant amount, they're above the floor. They're not going to be affected by the floor. They have to go up to $30, which is more than twice the current reported OPEX, CAPEX. They have to get up to $30 per barrel combination of the two in order to run the risk of that situation occurring at a $50 price. So they've got the $50 price. So they kind of brought that one down. That's what they consider so their high cost number. And then they've doubled their operating capital expenditures in order to say that they have a risk of the floor triggering. And so I just point that I don't think that's a realistic scenario anytime soon. And so, and that's why from our perspective, when you look at the question of whether or not this is going to affect their investment decisions, I reference whether or not it's a realistic part of their investment metric.
Okay, can you, Senator Wilkowski, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't see in this, the handout you gave us, anyway, the analysis they did on the different fields. And maybe you were getting to that next. But
what you refer to as the handout we gave, we were asked to comment on ConocoPhillips.
I know, so. but there's more, and I think, that's exactly what I was referring to. They did an analysis, and because quite frankly, the testimony that I heard from the oil companies was very compelling, that the gross minimum really does have an impact on their decisions. And we saw it, quite frankly, in the next few pages of the presentation that you have, where they showed how the gross minimum makes a number of fields uneconomical. And I'd like to hear your opinion on that, if that's possible.
Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first? Why don't you go first? No.
Chairman Huggins, the chair. Senator Wilkowski, I think we're referring to slides 12, 13, and 14 from Conoco's original presentation.
Okay, we're getting the whole packet here. I just did the one for the question I had, not for everybody, and I apologize for that.
I anticipated the questions as being prepared. I think what I can talk about is give a little background before we look at the specific slides. traditionally, and I'll talk from my experience in having made presentations such as this to bodies such as yourselves. Normally in the public forum, we've got three things that come into play in doing the economics that are presented here. One has to do with the reserves, the size of the reserves, as modified by the recovery factor that I apply to those reserves, is then modified by the production profile that I have overall. So there's sort of a production reserve piece. There's a market price piece, and then there's an expected operating cost piece that goes into it, as well as the capital cost to develop it. Traditionally, when presenting, I would present conservative cases in each of those. It would not be my most likely, but it would be a conservative case on production and reserves. It would be a conservative case on price. It would be a conservative case on what the cost would be. So that means I've lowered production, I've lowered the price, I've increased the cost. And so under that scenario, I would present data. Now, I'm not saying that that's exactly what Conoco did, because I can't speak for what they did. However, and they didn't tell us at what price they ran this, but their previous examples, they were running at a very conservative $50 price. So I do believe, my only supposition is that flows through to these examples. So you've got there first a lowering to a conservative price assumption. Second, it's my understanding that one of their fields is similar to the field A, but there's a different reserve figure, and that likely results from a different interpretation as to what the recovery factor is, one having a much higher recovery factor than the other person looking at the similar data. And so when you build that conservatism, what you come down to then is what they've done in slide 13, and I think this is a fair representation, is they gave you a spread of prices from 40 to 50, 40 to 60, my apologies. With the conservative volumes coming out and the higher cost, and said, here's a range in which we have some vulnerability on some projects we've identified. Now, when they're sitting down to make their decision, one of the things they're going to look at is what's the likelihood that over a long run we're back into this range of price environment, because if over the long run I'm in this price range, it's in the long run when I receive my income. I spend right now when it's $90 oil, but what I have to worry about is what it's going to be when I start receiving my income. And so therefore, they would have run this. And what that says for these particular projects, on a conservative nature, they do have some concern, and they do show that where the 10% minimum floor kicks in to potentially make the numbers on here worse. Now, what they didn't do is give you this plot up above for their fields under ACES, and I'm assuming it's not a misprint in the title, but they gave you a plot that's under the current PPT. So what you can't see, and what would have shown on here, is the inflection points on their economics when the minimum floor actually kicked in, to where you really could have seen, is that occurring more near 40, more near 50, more near 60?
I think our metrics are around 40.
42. And so that will give you an idea that, again, if there's a, quote, problem with the floor, it occurs at the very low end of the economic range that they're looking at, not at the top end. And thus, you know, whether PPT, ACES, the numbers on some of these projects are not quite above their line, sort of regardless of fiscal system.
And just to follow up on that, with the chart, when I'm looking at, I've got mine on two pages, so I'm flipping back and forth between slides 13 and slide 14. With slide 14, what it shows is under PPT, all the projects are economic other than 4 and 6. When you look at that as it's graphically displayed on slide 13, what it shows is that slide or projects 4 and 6 are the two that have data points at either 40, 50 or 60, where two of those, the 40 and the 50, are below this line in the middle, whatever that line, you know, that line is, I guess, their line for economic if it's above the line, non-economic if it's below the line. We don't know what that line represents in terms of dollars, but that seems to be their cutoff. So the projects that have that are above that black line at $50 are considered economics, that are below that line at $50 are considered marginal. You would anticipate moving from current PPT to the bill without the floor, which is the second column on slide 14, that the result on this graph is that all of these lines would basically be dropped some amount based upon the percentage increase in the tax. And from the way that it changes the representation, you basically have everything the same other than project two drops into the marginal category. And so that would seem to follow that project two, which is the closest one to this black line, must drop below it when all those lines drop down. When you get to the bill with the 10% minimum floor, what would be expected to happen, given that the floor doesn't trigger until the price drops down into the 45 to 40 range, that the 50 point and the 60 point would be the same under ACES with the floor or without the floor. But the $40 one is going to be significantly lower, theoretically. But yet it is being considered to make them all less economic. So it is a question for ConocoPhillips in terms of what this is intended to represent in terms of their actual decision making on these projects. If the $40 on PPT and on ACES without the floor is all sub-economic either way, how much of that is really affecting their characterization of whether it's economic or marginal? Because that's the only one that likely changed going from, in the chart that shows whether it's economic or marginal or non-economic, going from the second column to the third column, only the $40 probably changed, and yet it changed every one of the characterizations. So I think it's all a reflection of your risk assessment and making your investment decision. How much are you going to place on your lowest price scenario? And if that's going to drive your decision, clearly it didn't drive the assessment under the first two columns because it's sub marginal at $40 in any of the scenarios. And so it's just a question of how much further did it have to bring it to drag the whole economic profile into the sub-marginal category. So it's just a recognition that these aren't, they tend to look bright line on here, but clearly there's a big subjective aspect to the way they chose to characterize it, given the numbers that they have provided.
Senator Stedman? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering if the commissioners had the opportunity yet. I know you're real busy to go back and take a look at under the old presentations that we worked on PPT, what the banded range when we talked about the capital budget cycle of the companies doing business in the state as far as their targets, you know, high, medium, and their stress price. And we spent quite a bit of time trying to stay out of that range with progressivity in particular, not to impact their capital budgeting process. And if those numbers now have substantially moved upwards.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, that's not something that we have gone back and looked at or studied. What we've looked at is the primarily the investment opportunity provided by the question of how much money do you have to put in, all the numbers that we provided to you guys over the last week in terms of how much investment is going to be needed to bring that decline curve back up. And we tried to focus on that in terms of how much of the economic decision-making is going to be driven by the tax change and how much is going to be driven by other factors. And so that's some of the stuff that we're looking at right now.
Yeah, if I might, my motivation for asking the initial question is, number one, to give you a chance to respond, but more importantly, and Senator Wolodkowski's points well made, he had some other concerns. And, I mean, your answer is important to us, but equally important is it issues, the essence of issues are being raised based on proposals that are before us, and that those that are raising issues, that we close the loop with them so that it's either valid or invalid or it's unlikely scenarios. But by and large, my concern is that when we lay things out, mechanisms, that we understand what the ramifications are, and maybe semi-remote possibility, but if it's there, we need to figure out if we can live with those unintended consequences, and very simply. And I think you realize that. So I would just ask it, you know, that we close the loop with, in this case, ConocoPhillips, that they raised the issue. Because we're going to be asking for information and working and reporting and in any event. Since we have them written, unless there are other questions immediately, because these are not my questions, they were questions that were posed to us, each of us have this little cut and paste, and if we could go to the first question that was raised, I think this was by the Alliance, as I recall.
I think it was AOGA.
AOGA, that's correct. It was AOGA. If you could just answer those kind of in the sequence, because there were some pretty, I thought, heartfelt concerns. But continue, please.
Okay. I believe the first one, I actually gave my list to John, but the first one deals with joint interest billings. What we have done, the current statute provides in the section dealing with lease expenditures, there's some fairly detailed subsections that describe how the department should use joint interest billings in determining what lease expenditures should be allowed and what shouldn't be. What we have done, and we talked about it yesterday, is from a structural standpoint, is we have changed the obligation on the part of the Department of Revenue to define what are deductible expenditures. And we have also listened to the response of the auditors and the folks who were writing the regulations to implement PPT when they were trying to work out how to incorporate the joint interest billings into the audit process, into the identification of what is or isn't a lease expenditure. And what we found was, although joint interest billings are a key component of the identification of what costs have been accrued and which ones are appropriate under the statute, it's not the be-all end-all. It is a representation of the agreement between the parties, not a representation of compliance with the statute and the regulations. And so it's a necessary tool, but it is not the definitive answer. And so within the current statute, the language would provide a sense of requirement that it be one of the primary drivers at establishing the appropriateness of a deduction. And what we wanted to do was to reshape the section so that it is properly identified as one of the components of making that determination. And so the question that you have here is, what specific authority exists in the bill that recognizes the role of joint interest billings in that determination process? And I would refer you to page 42, if you have the bill before you, in section 57 of the bill.
Page 42?
Page 42 of the, well, 42 of my version of the bill, the Senate bill. Beginning on line 11, subsection 3, in determining whether costs are lease expenditures, the department shall consider, among other factors, the, and then subsection A, typical industry practices and standards in the state that determine the costs other than items in C, which are the exclusions that are specifically spelled out. But the operator allowed to bill a producer that is not an operator. So that's the joint interest billing reference. And so it makes a specific reference to the department shall consider joint interest billings in our determination of lease expenditures. So that's the answer. That's specific story that's being requested that allows joint interest billings to be.
Okay, so in this case, AOGA should not be, their concern is ill-founded?
Correct. Okay. It does make reference to the use of joint interest billings. It's just not in the way that it was established in the current statute, which proved problematic as we were developing the regulation.
Question.
And just to make it clear, this is language that exists in the current statute. It's just being moved to this section. In the current statute, it's the general statement at the beginning of the section, 165A. And when we just reorganized the section, this is being moved to it. Maybe that's why they didn't see it, that it got moved to a different section, and it's spelled out in this section of the bill.
Right. And question number two is the second, obviously, from AOGA.
Right, and for this one, I'm going to call John Iverson. He's been looking at this and getting the answer from our legal folks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm John Iverson. I'm the tax director for the Department of Revenue. The question that's been posed is in regards to Section 1 of the bill. And I've read a portion, at least. I just received this a few minutes ago, but I've read the relevant portion of the letter expressing some concerns from AOGA. And this intent provision does not have anything to do with interest. This is not affecting interest. This is actually only affecting the statute of limitations. So the concern that they are addressing in here is not being at all affected by this. Really what this is doing is it's just confirming that what we've already got expressed in regulations in regard to retroactive adjustments and the statute of limitations is being confirmed by this provision. One thing that I would clarify, in the letter itself, and I'm looking at page 13 of the letter, there's the regulation that's actually being cited there isn't the current regulation as well. There's a statement that we are adding in the statute, or in ACES, that we're proposing also to add adjustments to lease expenditures as a basis for retroactivity. There actually is an express reference to lease expenditures in the current reg, and that regulation is 15 AAC 55.820. But down to brass tacks, this isn't affecting interest, and I think that was the concern that they had.
Okay. And then finally, the third question, unless there are questions.
Keep John up here. With regard to extending the statute of limitations from 3 to 6 years, there's a number of different areas of concern that we have just related to what we anticipate to be the timeline as a fairly complex set of not only the returns that they provide to us, but also the interrelated returns that they're filing to the federal government and those that are connected to their partners, that there's a time lag that's involved as those issues are resolved among the partners with the federal government and then ultimately with us, with the possibility of there being adjustments because of the various changes that take place each step of the way. And because of the recognition that each one of these things could drag out some period of time, we were looking at our timeline and thinking that we're going to be put in a position where, while things are still kind of being resolved at various levels, our statute of limitations was going to come close to ending. We're going to have to jump to some conclusion, take a fairly strong position just to protect our interest in a variable world. And that it wouldn't be in our interest or the taxpayers' interest to cause that to happen. And so we wanted to allow the time to capture all the possible changes in the underlying discussion about the costs and the deductions and the interrelation between the partners, so that our statute of limitations time frame doesn't drive us to have to take a premature position.
In that respect, John, let me ask you, what is our, that lag factor, what is our current lag factor? I know that's one of the measurements you use in your audit process.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the time, and I'm assuming with the lag factor we're referring to the time from when the initial return is filed until we actually complete an audit.
Right. How far behind are we? I mean, you're always going to be behind. The question is, how far?
Mr. Chairman, it depends on the taxpayer, for one, because sometimes the information that we request is, it takes time for them to put that together.
Right.
It takes time sometimes for us to formulate our responses. Taxpayers often don't mind waiving time under the statute so that we can cooperate and get things done so we don't have to do a jeopardy assessment, which is what Commissioner
right.
Galvin was referring
yeah.
to as being crunched on the timeline. I can say tell you that for some of our audits right now, we are auditing as far back, I'm going to look back at Gary Roger, audit supervisor, I would say as far back as probably 04. Okay, so we have one that's as far back as 03, the other ones are 04, 05. So we're generally a couple of years behind.
And just to follow up on that, remember, the audits that he's referring to are not under a net tax. Those are audits under the previous tax system.
Right.
And when we went to the net tax, we recognized that there was going to be significantly greater audit requirements. We were authorized to hire additional auditors, and we're back here talking about the need for higher level auditors, although the same number. And when you ask what's our lag in the net tax related audits, the answer is none yet, because we're just entering that venture. And what we're looking at is having watched, or I guess the more accurate way is thought through the different pieces that each separately are going to have their own time situation, we've recognized that regardless of how quickly we get ourselves together, how on the ball our auditors are, there are going to be events that are outside of the state's control that are going to occur with that lag. And that's our primary concern with regard to the lag is are those events that are outside our control. That's not a matter of the state not having our sort of act together and letting time slip by, but making sure that we don't get ourselves caught by events that we can't control.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard, and I think many of us have heard from our constituents, rightly or wrongly, the deep concern they have over this auditing. And the thing that I hear, and I just need, I guess, you to say it to assure Alaskans so that I can go back to people in my district anyway, can we compete with the oil companies in auditing? Can we compete with them so that we get our fair share? I mean, I just need to know that, and I just need to be able to go back and say, hey, the Commissioner of Revenue has assured us that the provisions we have in here will enable us to do that.
Senator Wilkowski, I can assure you that with the requirements that we're putting into ACES and with the rest of the tools that we're asking for, including the auditors and so forth, that I have myself a high degree of confidence that we will be able to ensure maximum compliance, and whether that's going to be at 90 cents on the dollar, 95 cents on the dollar, whatever, but it's going to be, I believe, pretty darn close, that two things. One is, I believe that we're asking for what we need right now, what we believe we need, and we're going to put everything we can to it. I also believe that we will know within a couple of years if there's something else in terms of additional audit, we're going to bring in contract auditors, and if we're going to need some additional help, we'll know it within a couple of years. Within this administration, we recognize the responsibility and the challenge, and we're going to do everything we can to meet it, and we, I believe we can.
Thank you.
Okay. So I think, at least from my perspective, you've answered those three questions. Other questions? Yeah, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the 3 versus 6 year statute of limitations, the other issue that I've asked is the compounding rate for interest when there's an audit is 11%, is my understanding. And I'm just, we keep hearing about a 10% discount rate that the oil companies have, and we see profit margins that are obviously much higher than that. I'm wondering if we need to tweak that in a way. And that was one of the recommendations, if I recall correctly, of Pedro Van Mieris, was to increase the penalty. And I'm wondering if we need to go to a higher interest rate or something so that we can really ensure compliance.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I think that's a legitimate area of inquiry. And we're looking at it ourselves in terms of other places, what do they do to ensure compliance and make sure that the system doesn't inherently incentivize underreporting of income. And I think you're on the right track in terms of trying to compare what does a company evaluate in terms of their cost of capital versus or opportunity to say if they keep the money in versus what they're going to have to pay, and the, lack of a better word, arbitrage that they decide to sort of set up by taking advantage of that time value of money. We have looked at it, and the countervailing area is if there's a good faith disagreement, that you end up with a situation where you're penalizing somebody for basically exercising their right to disagree, and you want to make sure that you're not doing that as well. So I we're looking at it. I think it's something that I believe the next committee, in talking to the chair of the next committee, they're going to focus on. And so I think it's something that will get attention before the bill gets much further.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, John, help me out, but I was talking to Don Bullock a little earlier. And so I understand that there are some other mechanisms that kick in that up that percent. Would you just walk us through that quickly?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, if I may grab my bag.
Please. So it just doesn't die at 11%. I mean, there you have some other tools at your disposal that ups the pain factor, for lack of a better term.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. If we look in the general powers of the Commissioner of Revenue, we've got, in addition to the 11% rate on annual payment that is due, we've also got some penalty provisions for underpayments, and those vary depending on, I guess we could say, the level of culpability as to whether that would be negligence or a willful misconduct or fraud. The section that I'm looking at for the benefit of the folks in the committee is 4305-220. And the first section of that sets a 5% penalty, and that's based on the amount of the underpayment for either a failure to file or an underpayment or failure to pay. And that's 5% for every 30-day period or fraction of that 30-day period, up to 25% in the aggregate. Now, on top of that, in Section B of that same section, we've also got an additional penalty. So these add up as we go through as the culpability becomes more and more severe. Under Section B, if the deficiency or part of the deficiency is due to negligence or intentional disregard of a law or regulation, so it's a higher level of culpability there, without any intent to defraud, there's an additional 5% of the total amount that's unpaid on top of that. And then as we go into fraud, a civil fraud provision at least, in Section C, we've got a civil fraud penalty that's actually 50% of the tax due, the unpaid amount, again, on top of that, or $500, whichever is greater. In addition, there are
some criminal penalties. Those are in 05290, and those range, you know, fraud, willful misconduct. There's got to be some sort of level of intent with these, but they go as high as a Class C felony.
Okay. Yeah, I just recall there, I mean, there's some escalators that can get painful based on the conduct. Other questions of the administration? Senator Wagner?
Yeah, going away from this for a while. Rich, yesterday we heard from one of the companies that the total investment, capital investment, Prudhoe, was, I think it was $19.5 billion. That pencils out to about $1.50 per barrel of all the barrels that have been produced since they started producing oil out of that oil field. What would be a rule of thumb, or is there a rule of thumb, to come up with the OPEX on that, the operating cost expenses? Is it one for one, two for one? Is there any such animal, or is it just something you had to grind away and get the exact figures to come up with?
Senator Wagner, the chair, the rule of thumb would have to do with the type of field it was and the type of recovery it's under, and you know, you'd have to go back and say, how long was it under primary recovery? What were costs anyway because of the location and the environment relative to what they were in other locations? And there are a lot of variables to put together to come up and say, over the entire period, they averaged X per barrel. I wouldn't be able to do that.
I thought they were going to tell us, but then once they figured out we had the barrel cost, they didn't want to tell us what the operation costs were.
Yeah. So, I think one thing you could do for the estimate that you're looking at, I think to what you were driving at, Senator, was for a very long duration, they were operating in a $20 to $25 world for oil. And there was a cost structure that they had under that period, which I'm sure the DOR could find. And you could use that as a surrogate to say, over and for all the barrels they produced, the CapEx averaged this per barrel, the OpEx averaged that per barrel, and the market price was about this per barrel, to come up with what the spread was, to then be split between the companies and the government.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to remind my consultant that although in most other places you would think Department of Revenue would be able to get that information, we don't have that information.
Sorry.
Because it wasn't part of the tax system. And so we don't have the cost information associated with that.
Yeah, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard a lot of talk about, and obviously, I mean, there's two competing principles. We want to maximize the revenue to the state of Alaska. We want to encourage investment by the oil companies in Alaska. And we've heard presentations from the Big Three, plus others, that it will take a tremendous amount of investment to pull out the heavy oil and extract the significant resources that are left. Are you, when you look at the numbers, are you seeing a lot of the money that's being made in Alaska stay reinvested in Alaska, or are you seeing that money go outside of Alaska? And if you're seeing it go outside, is there a way that we can capture more of that?
Double-edged sword here. Senator Wilkowski, the chair. From the outside looking in, do I see money leaving? I'm working off all the various numbers that have been in both the administration's presentations as well as the ones given by the companies. You hear numbers such as BP being in the plus or minus $2 billion net profit out of Alaska, Conoco plus or minus $2 billion. You kind of know the working interest percentages of the different players in the fields and how they might relate to those two companies and the numbers that they reported. And it's easy, and I know I'm rounding quite a bit, but it's easy to say that based on those 2006 numbers, although there was roughly $1.9 billion invested, there was somewhere between $6 and $10 billion exported from the state as profit. And I would suspect that in 2007 calendar year, the numbers might be much the same.
Would you say those numbers one more time, Rich, so just emphasize what they are on both sides?
As I said, working with all the numbers I've seen.
Right.
And this is Rich's gut estimate. This isn't a detailed, rigorous analysis. But when you look at the profit made in Alaska that BP reported, you look at the profit made in Alaska that Conoco reported, you then look and say you're 27% of this, 30% of that, you've got partners as well in those fields, you would expect that the partners made similar profits because they have similar positions. There might be a little difference because of tariffs here and there. But that's where I get to a calculation that although they invested just short of $2 billion, which is not a small sum, that is a significant amount, but somewhere between $6 and $10 billion of net income is what the oil companies removed from Alaska.
That's the aggregate?
That's the aggregate for all the players.
Okay.
Rich's guess.
Right. And at which year are you looking at in particular?
I think all the numbers the companies talked about were for 2006.
Okay.
And then given what prices have done in calendar year 2007, even though costs are likely up more again, prices are also up significantly in calendar 07 versus calendar 06. So I would suspect that the numbers are going to look much the same this year again.
And just a reminder to Commission Revenue, we agreed that you were going to deduce that number for future reporting.
And, I mean, similar to I mean, it would be a...
No, you don't have to answer that.
No, I'm just saying it would be a very, very rough estimate based upon basically just looking at ownership patterns between the two larger fields and just taking a ballpark. But
right.
I think, you know, Rich has provided, I think, as well, an estimate of where that number could be.
But, I mean, we had two members that asked for the number, in this case for Exxon, and the closest we could do at this point in time is for you to deduce it, and we'll work on it in the meantime. Okay.
Well, I'll...
That's Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, and then just the second part of the question, and I don't mean to put you on the spot. I know it's probably a very complex scenario, but I'm wondering if we can capture more of that $6 to $10 billion that's leaving the state. I'm wondering if we can figure out maybe some tweaks to our system so that we can encourage them instead of taking that money and spending it somewhere else to spend it here.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't want to even start to think about making fiscal policy for something very important off the cuff. But I think what you do, and the experience we've had in designing fiscal systems over the last 4 years, is it's very important to figure out first what your drivers are. What is it that you're trying to accomplish as the state? Because there's an infinite number of systems that can be designed, depending on what you're looking at, and also what some of, if I can use the term, more generally, the environmental factors that come into play, such as the location, the cost structure, et cetera. But there are mechanisms that can be brought into play if you say a primary target is, I want to induce reinvestment in my legacy fields because there's a lot of potential there. Well, there's a number of mechanisms in play in the world. There's some that you could create that would be unique to Alaska that would be a means of saying some of that $6 to $10 billion that's leaving the state, I can make it, I can put a strong disincentive for that to leave the state, or I can give a strong incentive should they reinvest it in the state. And so that way, again, Alaska continues to partner with the oil companies for developing the resources that are here. So, I mean, it just, but then you have to balance that against the other goals you have about base levels of income, investment outside legacy fields, ring fencing legacy fields. I mean, there are a lot of moving parts here that have to be considered, but you can, if it's one of the key drivers of your that you're looking toward, there are ways of making that happen.
And I guess just my suggestion would be to ask the department to explore that a little bit more. We've got about 3 weeks left, and if there's a way we can tweak that to capture more of that, I would certainly appreciate doing that.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you.
Yes,
Senator Stedman. Back when we were working under PPT, we had some presentations by Econ One where we took the gross revenue in a couple of different years and then broke it out into its component parts of the information we had. You know, and I'm personally not too excited about or interested in profit numbers from ConocoPhillips, Exxon, and BP Mobil. What I'm interested in is where's the cash to the state? What's our cut?
And when we get to looking at the federal government take, the state take, and then the industry. And I think we can get derailed very easily by going down rabbit trails, worrying about one particular company's profit margin versus another one. It's irrelevant. We need to pay attention to the state take and make sure we get that balance correct. And as far as how do we keep the money in the state, we spent weeks and weeks on it, and it's the credit. You make it a financial inducement for them to reinvest the money versus send it back to home office to be allocated around the world. So we have the mechanism in place. And I know what the other day the same subject came up, but we can go back into our Econ 1 presentations and pull some of that data out and maybe update it for the last fiscal year. But there is no surprise that the Prudhoe Bay is a very profitable oil field. It's the biggest oil field in North America. It's 30 years old under different price regimes when it was put in. And to the earlier question I asked you, Mr. Commissioner, I think the number that was used on the upper band of their targeted investment modeling was $40 a barrel of oil. And the reason I asked it is because now we seem to be, doesn't seem to be the upper band. And my concern is that the industry doesn't just move that number around to suit the particular presentation in front of them or bill in front of them, that we're actually trying to get, as accurate information as we can. But again, the fundamental issue in front of us is the state take, and is it fair?
And I'm sure,
go ahead,
Senator Stedman, to the chair, that when we get to upstairs in the Finance Committee, we'll be looking at those numbers fairly closely. Mm-hmm. I know that we can pull that stuff together in terms of the state share in a particular year, taking that snapshot approach.
Yeah, Mr. Commissioner, the diesel fuel. I'm sure that the finance table, there will be discussion about plants and trucking and all those sorts of things. I would just encourage us to look at the ramifications of hauling fuel and that round trip and the safety and all the ramifications, because the estimate we got, that I, at least what I've been told thus far, is that DOT thinks it'd be about $2 million for the upkeep of the road, 100 vehicles a day sort of numbers that they're crunching it. I don't know. We did a stoplight the other day just outside of Wasilla. It's $1.5 million. So I'm not, my confidence level in $2 million for that stretch of road, given some, it could be dwarfed. But a greater concern, one crash, one fire, family that's going up to the North Slope runs head on. I mean, all those safety sorts of things. Or let's assume that we have a plant that's in Fairbanks, goes down, suddenly we're hauling from Kenai. I mean, all the
second,
yeah. but my point is, all the scenarios of let's be careful what we wish for. And so, if there is a way that we can work out within the administration a mechanism to be able to, number one, justify it, but if we could do that process up north and take the trucks out of the equation. And be financially responsible as far as the whole credits and taxes and what have you, I would just ask us, it might be smarter in the long run. Yes, Senator Wagner.
Actually, point of information, any diesel that goes to the North Slope will come out of Kenai, but it will be piped to Anchorage to take it off the rack there, because they are the only process that does sulfur-free diesel
in the state. The issue, the issue is multifaceted, because on the one hand, if we allow the deduction of the cost of building the low sulfur diesel topping plant, the state is basically contributing upwards of between $115 and $150 million to that plant, and it's going to take out of competition the ability of another competitor to create the same product and sell it to them, whether that be in Fairbanks, North Pole, or in Kenai. And I agree wholeheartedly that from the state's perspective, we have to consider all of the costs associated with it in terms of cost to the state and safety and the issues that you refer to in terms of having the trucks driving up and down the road should be one of those. But I think that it is a difficult issue that's complicated as much by the question of should we be providing a subsidy in the form of a credit to one particular company where another company is going to be creating the same product and making a profit off of the sale. And that becomes a difficult issue from the administration saying, yes, we're going to favor this. And to some extent, I mean, that's why this issue is one that within the decision-making of the department became a difficult call to make because the language was somewhat ambiguous with the existing law. We felt that it would be something that we would likely interpret the way that the statute currently, or the bill currently reads, basically excluding it, but it would be something subject to most likely a contest and a dispute, and that it's more appropriate for this issue to be dealt with at a policy level by the legislature in terms of making that determination. But we definitely recognize the trade-off and the cost associated with the trucking and so forth, but it's also a matter of ensuring that there's fair competition in commerce within the state.
Yeah. Well, I hope we don't put that issue to bed too soon because I'm concerned about the consequences of petition, what we're going to do. Other questions from? I have one additional question, and it appears to me that we would be out of question at that point in time. In the business of tax returns, as I recall, DOR has an agreement with the IRS about, which not an agreement, you're bound by some IRS requirements about what you can or can't share. I'm not sure, my first question is whether DNR have those same bounds or do they get information that would cause them to be bound?
Referring to federal tax? It must be federal tax.
Mr. Chairman, there are in terms of federal tax information, there are very strict confidentiality requirements that we have to follow in order to even have access to any federal tax information.
Right.
As far as
just to be clear, those would apply to any state agency that would be accessing. I mean, that's between the state and the federal government, and so it wouldn't be restricted to just one agency. The state wouldn't be able to, have that transfer to another department and disclose.
Well, that's exactly my point. I'm just trying to get this out on the table so we all understand, because we're being asked the provision of information sharing. And I'm not saying that's part of the information you're going to share, but I just want to make sure that we all appreciate some constraints that are there, in this case, tax returns, because we're talking about
federal
tax issues.
Right. Federal tax information is going to be bound by federal law.
Right.
And the state is going through our compact or agreement with the federal government in acquiring that information will remain bound by the confidentiality requirements of that agreement, regardless of what's written into this law.
Right. And I get my question on behalf of the citizens of Alaska is that are you the only department that gets that information and there are sideboards on it, or does DNR get, or are there multiples?
Senator Huggins, as far as the companies that we're talking about associated with, I'm sure that there are, for example, Health and Social Services is getting federal income tax information with regard to some of their programs, but if you're talking about
petroleum,
oil companies,
petroleum,
yeah, getting. I'm not aware of Department of Natural Resources having any federal income tax information coming through, and I looking. We'll look at our sharing just to see if it would be covered by the sharing provisions that are provided in the bill, but. The intent is to ensure that the information that we get from the companies is something that can be shared. But we'll look at it in terms of the federal income.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sure that we all understand. I mean, we're dealing with an issue that we all understand that there are some parameters that are out there, in this case, the IRS restrictions on sharing, that we just all know that, whatever it is.
And that will, those will not be impacted by the ability by any changes in this law, the state's going to be bound by those requirements regardless.
Yeah, okay. That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair. We're very, very careful with federal tax information is paired with other information as well, that is treated.
Okay, other questions or comments? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I forgot to ask this question before, but one of the models that we saw from Chevron was a risk economic analysis where they had basically saying that taxing the upside can discourage investment. Do you remember that? I can show you. I don't have copies for everyone, but it's this analysis. It's got a P90, a P50, and a P10. And do you remember now?
Yes.
And you know, it was a compelling argument. They look at the upside when they're analyzing risk and analyzing where they're going to explore and develop. And can you comment on this? Or just comment on that, the theory in general, the thought in general, that taxing the upside discourages risk.
Yeah, Senator Wilkowski, the chair, I think Chevron, out of all the oil companies, did the best job of putting forth an answer to your question about how their decision-making is done by laying out the five different pieces of information and then running you through the EMV, or the expected monetary value calculation, where in essence you're looking at, you know, how much do you risk if you have failure versus how much can you make if you have success. And one of the things that you look at when you have success is, am I going to have a low range of success, a medium range of success, or very high, very successful project? And the one thing that they did mention is that, depending on what you do with the fiscal system, if you just treat one end of it, which is at the high end, and you reduce that, then that necessarily flows through the, because it's just calculus at that time, so it just flows through the numbers and spits out an answer at the other end. But depending on what you do within your system, for example, extra credits for dry holes, immediate write-off of investments and credits, especially when I'm on the low case, can actually raise the numbers off their low case. So what they chose to do in that representation, I think it was fair to show how if you only impact the high end, it can change that EMV calculation to go from positive to negative. But you can also have some things that you're actually raising the lower end in their example at the same time, and those can have offsetting effects or maybe even have a positive effect.
Is that did the analysis that they gave change the way you – did that cause you to evolve in your opinion about ACEs or what we're trying to do here? Do you feel where there is enough protection in ACEs so that we won't adversely affect that analysis?
Senator Wilkowski, the chair, I haven't done that type of a detailed comparison between A and B as you explain them. But I think as you understand how they're doing their decision making, I think then we can overlay in our deliberations and our look at this over the next few days is overlay that against ACES and see what impact we believe ACES is having either positively or negatively on that decision making.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I also think, I mean, we're at the beginning of this process still. We're in first committee. You guys are going to be talking about a CS and amendments tomorrow, and I would anticipate that we're going to have still a lot of discussions about changes to different aspects of rates and floors and various other things. And I think what you've identified is one of the things that we need to keep in mind with regard to adjustments is are we affecting the upside, are we affecting the downside, are we doing both in a way that's going to, as Rich said, provide that countervailing where we're going to potentially make the upside look less attractive but the downside's going to look more attractive and those two will balance out. And so that's, I think, the primary message from the presentation is to make sure that you're paying close attention to what effect you're having and are you recognizing where it's coming into their decision making and not just focusing on how much more money is it bringing to the state.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Wagner, the name of the BP economist, the gal that was here at BPT,
Mitchell.
She did a very good job during PPT debate going over the capital budgeting process dealing with their banded targeted rates, high, low, and median, and then what happens in their process if we put in some changes within the tax structure that is kicks in substantially higher than their high rate. And we spent quite a bit of time going through that, and that's in the BP's testimony. And the bottom line is it didn't come into the realm of price probability, and it didn't affect their decision-making very much. As an example, if we did something at $150 barrel of oil, if they think we'll never hit $150 barrel of oil, it's not going to get in their modeling. It's not going to affect their decision process. So.
It's an understatement. Well, we'll be sure to go back and look at those materials because it will probably
she did
sound
job.
Like something you'll want us to look at by the time we get upstairs.
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions or comments, thank you very much again for the opportunity to have a discussion with you. And as you said, the conversation is just beginning, and the bill continues to move. And we just got to continue to work on it and refine and hopefully be out of here in 30 days.
Less than 30 days.
Yeah, less than 30 days.